This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The first question this month is from Philip, and who says, it is often stated that the relative abundances of primordial elements is supporting evidence for the Big Bang. Please could you explain this, because intuitively, one might have thought that as the universe cooled, it would have passed through temperatures high enough to synthesise every element, even the heaviest elements. Yet we're told that theory predicts pretty well what we see, hydrogen, helium and traces of lithium formed in the Big Bang.
Okay, yeah, so in fact, so Philip here is talking about, it's one of the, what we call the, perhaps the pillars of the Big Bang, so it's one of the main pieces of evidence for the Big Bang as the origin of the universe, and that's the creation of the light elements. So it's the creation of the lightest elements, as he says, hydrogen, helium, a little bit of lithium, whereas we actually believe that the heavier elements are formed inside stars. Now, what he's referring to and the question he's asking is, why isn't it the case that since we know that the Big Bang was really hot and presumably stuff was denser as well because everything was closer together in the past, in the early universe, why wasn't it possible to make all these heavy elements in the Big Bang? Now, I think it's probably worth having a little bit of a history lesson because I think it's an interesting story, actually. I think we learn a lot from looking at the history of these things. We'll go back to the 1940s, and actually some physicists called George Gamow, Ralph Alpher, and Robert Hermann. And they were actually working on what happened in the early universe. So by this time we knew the universe was expanding back, you know, back in the early part of the 20th century. Hubble and his collaborators discovered that. So the idea that the universe was in this hot, dense state had come about by then. And what Gamow, George Gamow and these other guys were thinking about was, they actually came up with this idea, which Philip is suggesting, is maybe all the elements are made in those, that early time. And how they're made is by just building them, sticking light elements together to make heavier elements. And in particular, they had an idea that you would just add a neutron into a lighter element, and by adding in further neutrons and building these elements up, you could make all the elements. And they had a paper that came out in 1948, and it was called The Origin of Chemical Elements. And that was the theory that they were proposing. Funnily enough, the paper was actually by three authors, Alpha, Beta, and Gamma.
Oh, fantastic.
So Alpha, Beta, Gamma, basically. So the Greek alphabet, the first three letters in the Greek alphabet. Now, it turns out that I mentioned that Alpha, Ralph Alpha and George Gamow were part of this team, but Hans Beta wasn't part of the team. He was a physicist who had worked on nuclear reactions in stars, in particular the proton-proton chain that you get in the sun. But they added him in. Gamow suggested they just added his name in to make it funny.
So they had a comedy paper name.
So they had a comedy paper name. And strangely enough, when the paper was submitted to a journal, it was actually sent to Hans Beta as one of the referees. So you might have thought, if he didn't have a sense of humour, he might have been very happy to see his name and appear on the paper. But apparently he was happy enough to have that happen. And he also thought the theory might be true. So he thought it might be handy that his name was on the paper as well.
It's pretty good that he agreed with it.
He did, yeah. No, so that was sort of, you know, that was a serious suggestion that all the elements were made in the Big Bang, sort of in the late 1940s. When they continued to do more work on that idea, they actually realised it wouldn't work, and it's basically down to details of the way in which these neutron capture processes work. I mean, it's sort of, you can imagine the stuff being, these neutrons being added to atoms, but also at the same time the universe is expanding, the density is going down, the temperature is going down, you have to make all these things work together, and they couldn't get that to work. And about the same time, there were others working on how elements were made in stars. So there's actually another paper which is given a sort of alphabetical name, which is B2FH, which is Burbridge, Burbridge, Fowler and Hoyle.
Wow.
And the authors are actually Margaret Burbridge and Jeff Burbridge, who are married, Willie Fowler and Fred Hoyle. And that came out in 1957, and it was called Synthesis of the Elements in Stars. And that basically gathered together a lot of work that had been done previously, plus their own work on how you can actually produce all the heavy elements inside stars, which is how we now understand things to be. It turned out that Fowler shared the Nobel Prize in 1983 for this, but you might ask, a lot of people worried about why, for example, Fred Hoyle, who also did a lot of work on that, didn't also get the Nobel Prize. And one of the ideas suggested is, Well, one idea is that people assumed that Willie Fowler was the main leader of the group, which apparently wasn't quite true. It was much more of a collaboration. But the other reason is that people think maybe it was because Fred Hoyle sort of mocked the Big Bang. So he was the one who came up with the name Big Bang originally, and he just said, you know, what a stupid idea, a Big Bang that creates the universe. You know, it's this sort of mocking the whole thing. So it might have been that meant that he didn't get the Nobel Prize for it. Now, so you sort of ended up with a situation there where you had Gamow and stuff, and people had come up with this idea of creating the elements in the Big Bang, then realised actually they couldn't create the heavy elements. They could create the light ones, but not the heavy ones. Around the same time, these others had come up with the correct theory for how the heavy elements are produced in stars. So it's all coming together there. And in fact, Alpha and Hermann, Ralph Alpha and Robert Hermann, who'd worked on the original Big Bang elements, you know, creating the elements in the Big Bang theory, had actually, as part of that, predicted the existence of the cosmic microwave background. So wow. They came up with that idea, and they said the universe should be filled with this radiation at a temperature of about 5 Kelvin, they said. Now, interestingly, that prediction really sort of got forgotten by most people because it was sort of in the context of this theory of all the elements being produced in the Big Bang that had been shown to be wrong. And so people sort of forgot they'd actually predicted this thing called the cosmic microwave background. Bob Dickey and others at Princeton actually came up with, sort of revived the idea, apparently independently. And so they said, oh, there should be this radiation. We're going to build a telescope to detect it. And unfortunately for them, just a few miles basically down the road, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson had already built a telescope to do something else entirely, mapping the sky. And with it, they actually discovered this cosmic microwave background. And Penzias and Wilson got the Nobel Prize in 1978 for that. And ouch. Poor old Bob Dickey didn't get it. And people sort of forget that Alpha and Hermann and people had predicted it as well some years before. So it's quite a good story. I've actually just contributed a little piece about it to a book about this. It's called the book called Litmus, Short Stories of Modern Science, which I'll put a link to on the website, which is well worth a read. It's not just that story. There's lots of other stories as well. So it's quite good. And I guess just to finish off that point, that was the history lesson finished. just to finish that off, this cosmic microwave background nuclear synthesis is one of the great pieces of evidence for the Big Bang now. Basically, the hydrogen, most of the helium, and a small amount of lithium-7 is produced in the Big Bang. And you can actually use these models to predict how much of these elements, deuterium, helium, 3, helium 4, lithium 7, how much of these elements there should be. And you can compare it to observations and sort of independent observations of things like the spectra of quasars and also observations of the cosmic microwave background itself independently agree, showing that this model looks to be a very good model actually, and is a really good piece of evidence for the Big Bang.
So the reason why we can't see anything bigger than those than lithium is because it's too cool, too quickly for the triple alpha process to occur.
Yeah, it's partly that. It's partly that the universe expands too fast, and so the temperatures go down too quickly to make enough of them. But it's also partly because of the way in which they thought you could add neutrons into these elements doesn't work. There's sort of barriers to doing that along the way that stop them from getting this very neat and simple idea of just adding sort of one particle at a time and building the heavier things. It was more complicated than they originally realised.
Can I ask you another question, which may or may not? You may know it. If in stars it's the triple alpha process that makes carbon from helium, how do the smaller nucleus like lithium and boron and beryllium form?
I actually think that most of the rest of the lithium and beryllium comes from carbon atoms, carbon nuclei being broken down by cosmic ray collisions. So actually they're not being necessarily produced directly in the nuclear reactions in stars, but they're actually the carbons being produced by triple alpha and then the carbons being broken apart into the lighter elements. So I think that's the answer to that one.
Fantastic. Thank you for answering my additional question in there. Our final question comes from Freddie, who was wondering if there are any meteor showers to look forward to this month.
Yeah, actually, it is a good question. It's always worth noting when there are meteor showers around. And I would say that you should Freddie should listen into Ian Morrison's Night Sky This Month piece on the Jodcast, because Ian usually, I think, remembers to say what meteor showers might be coming up any given month, so that's certainly worth listening to. But just to answer his question quickly, the next major meteor shower to come up is actually just about to happen, which is on expected to peak around November the 18th, and it's called the Leonids. Now, the Leonids actually, you know, meteor showers come from dust particles that are basically, a lot of them originate in the tails of comets. So they're basically dust that's ejected from a comet as it comes near the sun, melts some of the ice, leaves behind this trail of debris, and when the Earth passes through that trail, you get a lot of these dust particles crashing into the Earth's atmosphere, burning up, and we see them shoot across the sky as shooting stars. Leonids actually come from a comet called Temple Tuttle, very nicely, named after two people, Temple and Tuttle. And that last passed close to the sun in 1998. So it last sort of deposited a big amount of debris and dust into orbit some years ago now, back in 1998. And for several years after that, it was really a great meteor shower. And one of my best memories of meteor showers actually was sitting out in the back garden one November in a deck chair, but wrapped up warm, not with my shorts on. And I did have a nice glass of wine, actually. But, but sat in the back garden, basically with a deck chair, looking up at the time of the Leonids, and there were some spectacular ones. I can't remember exactly what year it was. It must have been around 2000, 2001, so it probably wasn't long after this big, you know, this perihelion passage close to the sun of Temple Tuttle. And they were great. You know, they were glowing at the front. They had smoky trails behind them. They looked exactly like lumps of stuff burning up in the atmosphere, which is what you want. But actually, it's sort of been fading away, I guess, now. And it's a bit hard to predict what we'll see. And that's because these dust streams are quite clumpy. So you get a lot of dust and then a gap. And it sort of depends exactly where these dust clumps are and where the Earth happens to be as to whether we'll get a good one or not. It's probably sort of going downhill, as it were, in terms of the number of meteors we might see. Also, the moon's quite bright for this coming one coming up, so it'll make the faint meteors hard to see. Still, November the 18th, probably worth looking out for. Coming up in December is probably the most reliable of the meteor showers. It's called the Geminids. Peaks around December 13th, 14th. Again, the moon's quite bright, so the fainter ones will be hard to spot, but again, worth looking out for. Just to say, the names of these meteor showers are the name of the constellation from which all the meteors appear to stream. So if you were to sort of stay out there and sort of make a little sketch of the direction of the little shooting stars that you see, and you drew that on the sky, then they'd all appear to point back at the constellation of Gemini in the case of the Geminids. It's just to do with the relative velocity of the Earth and the meteor streams, that they all seem to come from that particular direction. But the best thing to do, to be honest, is not go looking for Gemini, not worrying with Stellarium or something and think, oh, you know, where's Gemini? Where do I look? Best thing to do is really just look up. And I suppose if there was a moon, then maybe look away from the moon, because the moon will be bright, obviously. So look for a darker bit of sky on the off chance. There's a good story from the early days of Jodrell Bank, actually, where there was an astronomer came to help with the radar observations of meteors that were the first thing that was done at Jodrell back in the late 1940s. And one of the major pieces of equipment for those observations was a deck chair to sit in, and also a piece of string, because what was done was to sort of see a meteor stream and then hold up a piece of string against the sky in the right direction, and that gave you a quick measurement of how long the meteor trail was.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was before computers, obviously, so string and deck chair is very fundamental to meteor astronomy. And then I suppose after the Geminids, December, have a nice Christmas, have a nice New Year, and then just after New Year, January 3rd, 4th, there's a meteor shower called the Quadrantids. And the thing about the Quadrantids, in this case, the moon's going to be better, so the sky will probably be darker, so that would be good. The disadvantage, I suppose, with the Quadrantids is that the number of meteors you expect to see for a lot of these showers extends over several days. So you've got a chance, if you miss it one night, you've maybe got a chance the night before or the night after, sort of thing. With the Quadrantids, there's quite a lot of meteors, quite an intense shower typically, but that intense peak only lasts a few hours, and you can't exactly predict when it's going to happen, but probably the night of the third or fourth of January. But I suppose if the weather was bad or something and it only lasted a few hours, you might be unlucky and you might miss it. But it's sort of worth looking out for. We'll stick a few web links on the website for places you might want to find out more about these things.
Brilliant. Well, Freddie, good luck looking for all these meteorites, and I think I'll look out for them too. I need to get a deck chair now, though. So I'd like to say thank you to Philip and Freddie for emailing in some questions. And if you want to send in more questions for Tim to answer, you can do so via the webpage.